What kind of impact is global warming having on wildfires? What makes a wildfire a megafire? Are all of us at risk, even if we don't live near a forest? These are important issues to think about, talk about, and learn from people in the know. And that's just what we'll be doing for this next hour. And this one hits close to home for me. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of our world. And as always, a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of the show who helps make the production of Mrs. Green's World podcast possible, the Chapman Automotive Group. As one of America's largest car dealerships, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, about their customers, their community, and about the planet. For more information about their company and all they do to make our world a healthier place, please visit them at chapmantucson.com, and I really hope you will. Our show today really is one that hits home for me. Wildfires and climate change, wilder than wild, is our topic. And as many of you know, our dream cabin was burned to the ground in one of the biggest wildfires in Arizona history, and it was truly devastating. It's a forever devastation. There are only charred remains to tell the story, so this is really near and dear to my heart. Join me in welcoming Stephen Most, author, playwright, and award-winning documentary filmmaker. Stephen, it's really wonderful to have you here. We had two brief conversations before we got on, and of course, we both agreed that we want to thank our dear friend Mary Lou Duray, who is an incredible human being, for making this connection.
Well, Gina, thank you so much for having me on Mrs. Green's World on this podcast. I'm very much looking forward to talking with you.
There's so much to cover. I have pages of questions, so let's try to get to them. But, you know, I haven't asked this question of my guests for quite a while, but for some reason, I really felt compelled after reading so much about you and reading your book and watching the movie. Take us back a little bit about your life story. You're an author. You're a playwright. You're an award-winning film documentary filmmaker. Would you mind sharing with us how this path was designed for you, or how you designed it to make this your life's work?
This path I never anticipated.
I love that answer. I love that answer. I didn't expect to be here interviewing someone like you either.
Well, Kierkegaard said in his journal that one lives forward but understands looking backward.
And oh my gosh, I will take that from this show and use it.
When I was young, I thought, well, I want to be a playwright, because that's how I thought. I thought about the world as being composed of different people who see things in different ways, who act in ways that require responses. It's a view of the world that's not that of the single overarching ego that one sees often in politics and in the novel. It's a world of many people, and theater is a medium that expresses that so well. It wasn't a very practical career choice, though, to be a professional playwright.
Then there's that, which is making me feel good either. It's not the road to get-rich-quick scheme, that's for sure.
And often writers are advised to write what you know, but I'm not that interested in what I already know. I want to write about what I don't know, to use writing as a vehicle to learn. So writing plays on subjects that inspired me and interested me led me to do some journalism. And then I discovered that if I went with a film crew, anybody would talk to me. I could go places that as a freelance playwright and reporter I would never have access to. So that's how I've managed to combine over the years playwriting with some journalism and documentary filmmaking. When I started working with documentary filmmakers, I realized that I had something to offer as a playwright. The basic concepts of dramatic structure, the idea of character, you don't think about people in the world as characters, but you have to think about them in that way if you're going to craft them into a film, whether it's a documentary or a feature screenplay. The idea of plot, the idea of scenes, what is a scene? an overarching theme that gives structure to the whole, some question that is unresolved that keeps people watching. All of these ways of thinking that dramatists have developed for 25 centuries, I could bring to documentary filmmaking. So that's how it all came together.
And, you know, it's a crowded space. I mean, I like to say that. It's a very crowded space. It's like being a podcaster. It's like being an actress. It's really, really a crowded space. Lots of people want to be. You got to the award-winning part of it and acclaimed, which is quite an accomplishment. So tell us about the film, Wilder Than Wild, Fire, Forest, and the Future. Tell us what it's about, why you wrote it and produced it in the first place. What grabbed you out of the myriad of topics from which you could have chosen?
And actually, it's quite a commitment to make a documentary film. It means years of your life. It means a lot of fundraising with no guarantee of success, either in being able to support the film economically or in having a good film, because you never know with the documentary what you're going to come out with. You know, what is going to happen? It's a moving target. But I thought that this was an important subject that nobody was looking at in the documentary film world. I had worked on a film about fire and forest health with a prominent forest ecologist, Malcolm North. And I'd written a documentary about a great conservationist, Aldo Leopold. So I had some familiarity with the subject. And then I was advised to take a close look at the Rim Fire, which was the largest forest fire in California history. I was told that fires are different in this century. And so I started researching it at the time of the Rim Fire in 2013, which consumed a large part of the Stanislaus National Forest and a smaller section of the Yosemite National Park in the Central Sierra. And I learned, to my amazement, that forest fires are consuming three times as much land as they did as recently as the mid-1980s.
Three times as much?
Yes, each year.
Wow.
And the extent to which these fires burn severely rather than in ways that are ecologically beneficial has increased as well. And so why is this? Clearly this is an important phenomenon. And this is a global phenomenon for one thing, but ecology is different everywhere. That's what ecology is about. Each place is unique. And in California particularly, the forest that we have evolved with fire because the tribes burned regularly for all sorts of cultural and practical reasons. So we have forests that evolved with fire that need fire, but the federal government owns most of the forests in the West, and especially California, and has had a fire suppression policy since the 1930s, and a very, very effective one. So we have crowded forests whose number of trees per acre multiplied. And then
can I just interrupt you for a minute? Talk about what a fire suppression policy is. What does that mean?
Well, in 1910, there was a huge forest fire in the West that consumed millions of acres, and the number of, I think, 75 firefighters died, and this really galvanized the Forest Service to make stopping fire a central policy. After all, the Forest Service is a conservation organization that wants to grow trees for use.
Got it.
And all of a sudden, these huge fires destroyed many of the forests for a long period. And in the 1930s, a whole set of responses came into play. Fire roads, watchtowers, and the introduction of aviation. Parachuting was invented by the Forest Service before World War II. And then after the war, all of this military equipment became available. So what the Forest Service did, in effect, was institute a war against fire. The idea was you put out a fire as soon as possible, by 10 a.m. of the day after it ignites, if possible. And they had all of these people trained to go way into the backcountry where fire does no harm and put these things out. So that's the fire suppression policy. And then, of course, when that becomes combined with the effects of climate change, we have a real problem.
So basically, the translation of that is natural fires occur in nature when conditions were whatever normal is, and suppressing them, and my husband is a former firefighter for the Forest Service, so I know which side I weigh in on, suppressing them seems to be not the wisest path we could have taken. That in many cases, they do a lot of natural correcting in nature. They are part of nature, and they get rid of undergrowth, and new things grow up. Is that a safe or an accurate assumption, more importantly, that in some cases, these mega fires are a result of so much suppression? Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, except that we tend to separate nature from people. And native people do not. They see what we consider nature as part of their community, part of their everyday life.
Yeah, so imagine
having
that.
having fires was just something that you did for many reasons. It reduced the risk of a fire that would threaten you. It opened up space for wildlife, including game animals. It stimulated the plants that you harvested for food and plants for basketry materials. So people burned. People burned regularly. When we created the national park system, the idea was that nature is separate from people, and the natives were expelled from the national parks. But it was the Park Service before the Forest Service that came to realize a few decades ago that prescribed fire was actually a valuable tool.
Yeah, and
so they reintroduced
it. Yeah,
that's right. They reintroduced fire systematically into the national parks, whereas the Forest Service is much more reluctant to do that, since for them timber is a commodity.
Got it. Boy, there has to be some regret in some people's mind given what's happened. So, Stephen, what makes something a regular forest fire, and what makes it a mega fire? How does a fire get the tagline mega fire? Is it simply size, or is it ferocity? Is it, you know, they're ferocious. So what makes a fire a mega fire?
First of all, a very small percentage of the fires, the thousands of wildfires that occur every year, a very small percentage counts as a mega fire. And this definition is that 100,000 acres have to burn for a fire to count as a mega fire. And it has a higher percentage of severe burning than ordinary fires, because many fires do good ecological work. They may be moderate or low in intensity. A severely burning part of a fire is going to actually take out the large trees. It's a crown fire. It may not lead to succession by another forest if
right.
It consumes too large an area
right.
to kill off the seeds.
So give us a sense for, you know, how bad is it? You immersed yourself. You put your life into this story of ferocious wildfires and megafires. What's the magnitude of the problem? You also said not all fires turn into mega fires. What are we sitting on? Are we literally sitting on a fire keg? I mean, what's your sense, having lived it and worked it and produced this incredible film? Where are we? How bad is it?
It's pretty bad, depending on where you live. California has suffered some enormous fires, and there are different dimensions to this problem. It's really complex.
Yes.
So I can't give you a short and comprehensive answer. But part of the problem is that with increasing population, people have been living in areas that are forested and or other kinds of wildlands like chaparral. So you have something called the wildland-urban interface, in which people live right up against the edge of wildlands, and or the wildland-urban intermix. Both go by the acronym WUI.
Okay.
And we WUI baby, do we have a problem? Because people are moving into the wildlands, but at the same time, because of the spread of flammable vegetation, these fires are moving to where people are. What was so astonishing for many people last year is that you had a wildfire that consumed an urban area. In fact, several urban areas at once in California. So this is one part of the magnitude of the problem. But there's another aspect that I should mention, which is that we're in the midst of a vicious cycle. These fires are so large, in part because of all of this contiguous vegetation due to fire suppression. You have really crowded forests and unhealthy forests as a result. But on top of that, add climate change, add drier climates, higher temperatures, extreme weather like really powerful winds, and these things make what would be a huge problem anyway even worse.
It is literally the perfect storm for disaster, the recipe for disaster, when you put all those things together with climate change as the, you know, the foundation of what's happening. It's pushing the conditions to new heights.
Exactly, and it's the perfect firestorm, and it's one that is getting worse because of a vicious cycle. As these mega fires release huge quantities of carbon into the atmosphere, that exacerbates climate change, which leads to more extreme weather, more mega fires. So we can expect an increasing trend of these perfect firestorms unless we face up to this problem and act. And the good news is that there are things that people can do.
And that's that. I would love to talk about it, but let's do a little bit more of the kind of the reality of the bad news, because as I was researching this, I kept thinking about when there are two or three or four mega fires burning in several states, how can communities respond? I mean, what community is positioned with the resources and the manpower and the money to fight things of this magnitude? Are they? Is it devastating communities economically as well? Who pays for all of it?
This is a huge problem. And until recently, the Forest Service was paying for a lot of it. More than half of their budget has been for firefighting. This is up from 16% in the 1980s. Now it's 55%. That means that there isn't money to do preventive work.
Right.
Which costs money to do prescribed burns or even manage wildfires. You have to watch them to make sure they don't get out of hand. Also thinning, the combination of thinning and prescribed burns is really necessary, because you have to have, you know, some matter for the forest to burn through clearings and so on. That's what the fire scientist Malcolm North discovered in a 20-year study of fire and forest health that I did a film about. So there are things that can be done, but and it's not just federal money. When there's a huge fire, you have thousands of firefighters from all over the country, and some of them are urban fire departments. When we had the Wine Country wildfires, you had firefighters from cities coming with wildland equipment, and as a result, these communities didn't have as many firefighters as normally they have, and yet their budgets don't pay for additional fire engines, additional equipment. So we're behind the curve on this.
And we have to hold that thought, because we're going to take a short break, and it of course it brings up when those firefighters leave their communities, then those communities are vulnerable from regular fires. So everybody, I hope you're hanging on Stephen's every word like I am. Stay here with us. There's a lot more important information to share. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for joining us. And just a brief request from me and the Mrs. Green's World team. We hope that you agree that we're doing our part to create a global community of people who truly care about this planet, about our health, and about the health of those we love. We would love to have you help to continue supporting us, to help us expand our work, to continue our current work. And you can join our movement by visiting MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member. And needless to say, we really hope you do. There's lots more that we want to do in this journey to a healthier and more sustainable planet. Wildfires and climate change, wilder than wild. Joining us for this hour is Stephen Most, author, playwright, and award-winning documentary filmmaker. He has writing credits for 4 Academy Award nominated and 5 Emmy Award-winning documentaries. His works include several books, a film, and 3 plays about the Klamath Basin, which I want to talk about. In Stories Make the World, Reflections on Storytelling and the Art of the Documentary, he shows how subjects in the world can be depicted as stories for the screen. And we are going to ask Stephen to talk about that if we don't run out of time, because I have so many questions, and about how these stories may have influenced his work. Stephen, thank you so much again for being here. And let's talk about the costs, the manpower costs, the money costs, the vulnerability costs for these fires. I didn't even think about it. They don't just have fire suppression crews that fly in from Arizona to fight in California. It's all hands on deck when they're this big.
That's right. There's a national emergency response system. It's not just for wildfires, it's for other disasters. And literally thousands of people can be mobilized to fight one fire.
And the cost, like for the wildfire, I looked it up and it was about $80 million. Well, that was probably not in any budgets. There's so much loss. There's obvious loss of trees and all kinds of vegetation, loss of wildlife, and in many cases, fires burn so hot that the soil is actually sterile, which is what happened in our cabin. And they said nothing will grow there of any substance for at least 50 years. I mean, it's literally sterile ground. And some of these losses are devastating. Can you paint a picture for us how bad things are? We are going to get to the good news, I promise. But are these mega fires really devastating the land on which they're happening?
There is a difference of opinion about this. Some people recognize the value of burned forests, of snag forests, or kinds of wildlife.
That
need snag forests, blackback woodpeckers, for example. So it's complex. There are good parts and there are bad parts. But if you have a snag forest that's extremely extensive, as we're getting with megafires, then there isn't a feed source that can really replenish that forest. And the danger is that when all of these dead trees fall in a kind of jack straw jumble, that's going to be like kindling for the next mega fire. We could have the loss of forests and therefore the loss of carbon storage, and this whole thing can get worse.
So the beat goes on, and you know, there's the loss of trees and all of that we discuss, but from my work, the people that are always the hardest hit, and you see this happening more in places like California and areas where they are more heavily populated, Sonoma, for example, people on the lower side of the socioeconomic scale who couldn't afford insurance. The marginalized communities are always the hardest hits. What's been your experience about that?
That has certainly been the case in Sonoma County. That's where we did some filming during the Wine Country wildfires. But Tubbs Fire in particular took out a residential area called Coffee Park. And there were people there who were renting, who didn't own the property, but will never be able to live in that area again because the rents are going way up with the loss of thousands of houses, 9,000 houses burned in the Wine Country wildfires. And adding to that, this is a wine country, so you had a number of Latin American people who were working in the vineyards, and many of them were afraid to go for disaster relief and make their names known. So there was actually a group of people who went off the charts. I know some went to Point Reyes Station to seek disaster relief anonymously from a really generous community that recognized their situation. I have a good friend who's actually the subject of my previous film, Bernie Krause, a great soundscape ecologist, and his home in Glen Ellen was burned to the ground, and he had to live somewhere else. He found that the rent in the place that he moved to was exorbitant. He was able to have his insurance pay for it, but so many people who lost their homes didn't have insurance.
But their lives could be devastated forever. I mean, really, forever. Never to have homes again. And I hear these stories about areas all over the country, even in like Taos, New Mexico, where my daughters live. There is so much with Airbnbs that people that are line workers and that are doing the hard work, like cleaning the hotels and doing the landscaping, they can't afford to live there because there's no place to rent. And if there is a place, it's so cost prohibitive. And when you add the mega fire impact on that, it's not a pretty picture.
It's not. And even for people who did not lose their homes or did not lose loved ones, I've been screening Wilder Than Wild in areas hit by these recent fires in Ukiah, in Sonoma, Santa Rosa. And I've never had this experience before. When the film is over, the lights go on, you stand in front of an audience, people are weeping. People have undergone PTSD because of their experience with these fires.
I believe it. I so believe it. It's just life-changing. And let's talk about, some of our listeners might be thinking, but I doubt it because of the kind of listeners that I have, that mega fires are awful and tragic and they're aware of global warming, not quite sure what they can do to stop mega fires. But isn't there something that impacts all of us about these fires on our air quality, our water supplies? Why should we all be concerned and stand up and take note and maybe, you know, change some behaviors? What are your thoughts on that? Why should we care about a mega fire in Sonoma? Other than that we're, you know, decent human beings. I don't mean that, but I mean, at a deeper level, isn't it impacting the quality of our lives as well?
Well, first of all, forests themselves, even though we don't live near them, add a lot to the quality of our lives. They produce oxygen.
Right.
They store carbon.
Right.
They store water. They're a source of wildlife. They're places we like to go to for recreation. They're very important to us, and we're often not aware of that. That's one reason I thought the Rim Fire was a good way to focus a film about wildfires, because San Francisco gets water and power from the Tuolumne River, which runs through the burn area, and also Yosemite is known worldwide. So we thought people would appreciate what was at stake with the Rim Fire. Now, when we talk about a place like Sonoma, the loss of life, the loss of housing, that becomes a kind of a warning sign that these fires are not just forest fires, they could go anywhere. And of course, the largest forest fire in California history. the Thomas fire occurred in December. So we don't even have a fire season anymore, and there aren't enough people to be fighting these things, responding to these things year-round. So all of a sudden, we need to think not only about financial resources and having enough firefighters and equipment, but also what we can do proactively. And just to give you an idea of what's at stake here, deforestation, including these forest fires, is as great a source of greenhouse gases as transportation worldwide. So, you know, we think about getting an electric car or a hybrid. Well, what we're able to do with transportation is just one part of a much bigger picture. We have to be able to store carbon. But you see, that turns us toward one of the positive things that we can do, because forests are a great way to get carbon out of the atmosphere. And so planting trees can have a tremendous effect. One of the scenes in Wilder Than Wild is children planting trees in the Sierra. And this has the effect also of getting them to appreciate being outdoors, being in nature. So if we really are proactive, that's one of many things we can do that would be very positive.
And I think you can do that anywhere. We have a massive campaign going on in Tucson to plant 1 million trees by the year 2020 for a cooling effect. I mean, look where we live, Stephen. It's been 103, 105. It's going to go up to 107 this weekend. And we're in a tinderbox. I mean, here's an example in terms of the threat of these fires to urban areas. I had a conversation recently with a friend who works for the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum, which is world-renowned. We get hundreds of thousands of visitors from all over the world visiting that jewel in the desert. And we were talking about the threat of fire in Arizona because of buffle grass. It's an invasive species. It's everywhere you look. It's threatening the survival of our saguaros. Shouldn't we all be paying attention and try to find out what we can do in terms of fire prevention, or am I dreaming that? Is it not a threat to a lot of areas?
It is. And the thing about the wine country wildfires is that nobody expected what happened.
Right.
These fires broke out at 10 at night, 10 on a Sunday night. Many people had gone to bed. And all of a sudden, I mean, who would have thought that they would have had to flee their homes from a wildfire. So it's something that we need to think about in a different way. You know, we tend to think about, especially those of us who are urban dwellers, we tend to think about fire as something that will happen in our homes, that, you know, there might be an electrical problem. But wildfires take on whole areas, just like they take on whole forests. So suddenly, we have to look at what's outside our homes and understand the vegetation, the topography, but also have a renewed sense of who we're living with, who our neighbors are, because some people are infirm, some people aren't mobile. And we really have to think about this as a community and figure out ways to respond together. Having emergency warning systems that really work, for example. That's one proactive response to this new situation.
What a wonderful thing to say. I mean, I talk about goosebumps, and I say you can't fake goosebumps, and I got them because it really begs for connection to our community and to our neighbors and to nature and being aware. I mean, I remember my husband coming home from some pretty big fires that he was on for weeks and saying to me, the fires create their own weather conditions. I mean, you just, all of a sudden, they're creating the wind, and it's just something that you can't, he said, you can't even get your head around it unless you are on the fire line to see exactly how fast things can change and how fast they can move. So it's, yeah, everybody pay attention. And what is the downside of paying more attention to your community? There is none. It's like, it will make you feel better. Trust me. In the film, the ecologist Malcolm North says, we are at a tipping point and we have to decide one way or the other or another. Tell us why we are at a tipping point and what do we really have to decide?
We're at a tipping point because we're now in danger of losing our forests. We're in a situation where forests may become an emission source of carbon rather than a storage of carbon. And that, of course, just exacerbates climate change. It's a vicious cycle that is running out of control. It's like the cycle in the Arctic in which higher temperatures melt sea ice, which opens up the dark ocean, which draws more hot temperatures, which melts more sea ice, and it goes on. Well, that's something like that is happening with forests. We're at a tipping point, though, also because it's a point of decision. There are things we can do. One of the things we can do is, and this isn't easy for a lot of people, is to tolerate smoke. Because one of the best ways to deal with the threat of megafires is to support prescribed fires, which emit much less smoke. They can occur under controlled conditions when the winds aren't going toward populated areas. But people don't like that. We have air quality boards that often prevent prescribed fires. But when you think about it, by allowing the vegetation to build up and having fires under the worst possible conditions, you could have many times the magnitude of smoke from a prescribed fire in a megafire. It would just be overwhelming so that people can't live in your area at all for a while. So that's one thing that we can do. Another thing that we can do is, as I was saying, think about our community. Think about who we're living with. Think about dealing with vegetation near our homes. If my neighbor has a lot of flammable vegetation right next to his house or her house, well, the burning of that house is going to affect mine, but we can work together to open up, for example, some space that will make us all more secure. One of the things we're doing with Wilder Than Wild, we're not that interested right now in broadcasts and so on. We'll do that next year. But what we want to do is community screenings. We want to use the film as a way to get neighbors together to talk about this and then to be proactive. So one of the things that we've been doing is bringing together a scientist, a firefighter, and a public official so that there can be discussion and Q&A about the specific circumstances of each place where the film is screened and specific things that people can do. For example, we had a screening in Berkeley and there happened to be a number of initiatives that I didn't know about until a reporter told me in advance. You know, there's a Pathways Society that's looking at alternative evacuation routes in the hills. The fire department has emergency response training that people can do to help each other. There are all sorts of active ways. And, of course, where do you go? Where do you go in the case of a disaster? You should know that. What are the alternative routes to leave in an emergency? All of these things we should think about in advance. And having community events like community screenings of Wilder Than Wild, that's one way to respond.
Here I sit saying I've been in this role as an environmental educator for going on 11 years. That thought never occurred to me. I will say, however, that my daughter lived in LA for 20 years and just moved back here. And we had a plan for how would we get in touch with her if there was an earthquake, because that danger is real and imminent, and they're making plans for housing 4,000 people. I've been reading some bizarre things about that, and you just see it happening. But it is such good advice that you're giving us, and it's all at the foundation of community and connection. I don't have a clue where we should go or what we should do, and we're sitting in one of the hot spots of the world right now. I mean, we're having the driest spring ever. everything. The cactuses are, the cacti are crying for water. It's, everything looks like it's like been sucked up into its small estate. So it's something that I hope our listeners all around the country take a look. What is outside your door? What's outside in your neighbor's door, you know, in their yard, and try to figure out, you know, be inspired to be a change. So we are going to take another short break, and I have one more question about the film and the premiere in September, and then I'd really like to talk a little bit about your book, because it's a wonderful book. So everybody, please stay here with me. More really great content to come from an incredible change maker. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And as always, I thank you for listening. And I want to thank my team. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately, and some of them remember on a consistent basis to remind everyone that I show up as the host, but there's a lot of moving parts to make all of this happen. And you know who you are because you listen to our shows. So I hope this puts a big smile on your face, and know that I appreciate each and every one of you for helping the wheels on this bus go round and round. Today we're talking about wildfires and climate change, and it is wilder than wild. Joining us for this hour is Stephen Most, author, playwright, and award-winning documentary filmmaker. So Stephen, there's a big happening in September, on September 8th in San Francisco, and I'm putting it out to the universe that I must be there. So tell us about what's going to happen in September.
In San Francisco in September, there will be a global climate summit. There will also be on September 8th a climate march that's separate from the summit. And the evening of September 8th, which is a Saturday, Wilder Than Wild will have in San Francisco premiere at a wonderful theater, the Cowell Theater at Fort Mason. And prior to that, and this is a wonderful thing that I'm very excited about, members of the Yurok tribe will bring salmon from the Klamath River and have a salmon bake for 500 people before a screening. This is very much connected to the film because we have a scene of cultural fire which has been renewed by the Klamath River tribes, including the Yuroks. So this has been a very important development for them, and it actually was important for the California Fire and Forest Agency in supporting the tribes in doing this for the first time last year.
So it's really going to be a big deal. And I did check with Meredith on my team about to see if I was right about the Global Climate Action Summit. And you have to put your name in to be invited. So, Stephen, if you have any juice, pull some strings for Mrs. Green to get invited, because I would think I died and went to heaven. There's my bold, shameless plug right there. I mean, there's no mystery around me. So anyway, so let's switch to topics for a bit, and I'm really hoping that I can be there. It would be wonderful. And we're not really switching topics, because I don't think they're separate in terms of your life's work. It's all part of a woven pattern. Your most recent book is what I would call a beautiful and compelling book, and I don't say that lightly. It's a beautiful book. And that's a weird word to describe a book, but that's what came up for me. It's a thoughtful book, if that makes sense. And the name of it is Stories Make the World, Reflections on Storytelling and the Art of the Documentary. So give us a sense for what the book is about and what inspired you to write this, because you didn't have enough going on.
It occurred to me that everything that I'm doing, whether I'm writing a book or a script for a documentary or a play, it's all storytelling. But beyond that, storytelling is something that is a really basic human experience. In fact, and it's in all dimensions. When we think about ourselves, when we think about our identity, we're really updating a story about who we are and the story about the people in our lives. And, of course, politicians talk about the narratives. And so we're living in a world of narratives. And this, I think, is an important thing to bear in mind because we're exposed to so many false narratives. And we're also exposed to fragmentary information through the internet, through social media, and we don't see it in context. So I thought that writing a book about the making of documentaries would be a contribution to our time, because what does it mean to understand something? Well, for a documentary filmmaker, it means to look at a subject from multiple points of view. A world is comprised of many people, and we all look at the same thing, but from our own vantage point. And when you make a film over the course of years, you get to know everybody that has information, a valid point of view. One considers this skeptically. You have to ask good questions, evaluate the results, the responses. So this is a way of really understanding your subject. If you don't understand your subject, then you can't make a good film about it. But I think this is a skill. Looking at something impartially from multiple points of view, that all of us have the capacity to do. So I wanted to tell some stories about the making of films, including Wilder Than Wild, that would offer models for my readers to bear in mind.
And people in this day and age like stories. When I do presentations now, I try to make it a story. It's not about data points and, you know, Google Doc presentations and PowerPoints. People like to hear stories because we're just inundated with information. And if you can stand up there and make it personal and tell a compelling story, I really think that's where people are in terms of receptivity to these kinds of things. In the book, you highlight five storytellers and talk about the impact on your life and other things. And we don't have time to go into each of their fascinating lives. And you certainly pay homage to each of them. But did any one of them stand out in terms of greatest impact in your life? And if so, how so? That's a big, bold question.
I would name two people who were very influential, who were mentors. For me, one was Eric Erickson, a psychoanalyst who created the whole field of psychohistory.
Right.
And his whole concept of identity and the identity crisis, I came to understand was really about storytelling. The identity crisis occurs when your story about who you are breaks down. It doesn't make sense anymore. Erickson was studying veterans with, they called it shell shock. Now it's PTSD. You know, the sense that you're lost, you don't know who you are. That appealed to me greatly when I was an adolescent. I can tell you that, Gina.
So,
I think many of us have that situation in our lives when we're trying to figure out who we are.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, I went to the Peace Corps. I started acting in a different culture. I realized I didn't know how to think about it, and I didn't know how to really take responsibility for what I was doing because I didn't know what I was doing. So I was fortunate to go to a graduate program with Hannah Arendt, who is a great thinker about the history of the 20th century, but she was also very much a storyteller. And it so happened that the things that she had to say about storytelling, which she never put together in her own writings, have influenced me throughout my career as a writer.
So it's funny to me, and we did not rehearse this, but I did, I have, you know, what I do, I put stars and asterisks and tell Kelly to get this person on the show in my books. They're all a mess. I could never do just an iPad, which I know would be the greener choice, but I need to mark up my books. So I want to read a piece from Hannah, even though it'll take a little time. And it's funny, like, it sounds like we rehearsed it because of what you said about understanding. And it should make you laugh that this is what I picked. Stories make the world and stories limit it. And it's in the chapter about Hannah. Those who favor tales that support their identities and advance their ends while shunning or censoring all others maintain a fixed horizon. Like, I love that. Unless the unexpected breaks through those boundaries. For others, stories bring all kinds of people, situations, and knowledge into view until events I'm having trouble reading because I had cataract surgery. Let's share that with the world. Until events that have no precedent leave them in the dark, unable to grasp what has happened. Telling stories of unprecedented events and, in doing so, seeking to understand them was a central concern of Hannah Arendt's. I hope I said her last name right.
Yes.
The quest for meaning, she wrote, is in no way different from men's need to tell the story of some happening they witnessed. For her, the happening whose meaning she needed to grasp, above all, was totalitarianism and genocide. And here's the line that got me, and I starred it and put red pen on it. The most important thing for me, Arendt told an interview, is to understand. And that's what you're talking about. It's like stories help us understand. So why did so many people fail to understand her? Because they did.
She told a story that people didn't want to understand.
Oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. It is the truth. We don't want to hear it. That is like truth. I'm coming out of my chair. It hurts to listen.
Yes, and let's take climate change. This is not an issue in politics nearly to the extent that it should be, but people don't want to hear it. Your listeners are exceptional in that regard.
Truly.
But this idea of what's happening to our planet and what this means for future generations, I'd rather watch a comedy. I'd rather sing a song. This is just not good news. And the idea that we have some responsibility for it and might have to change our lives, tell me something else.
Right. Don't want to hear it.
So the challenge then is to tell stories that will engage people so that we will take this into account and act accordingly.
And I just wish that any news station, and I mean any, left, right, in between, if there is such an in between, or stories that actually tell the real news, which who knows what that is anymore, would be including climate change as a part of their regular reporting. I mean, the social justice pieces of it, the climate refugees, what's happening in Houston? Have you checked in lately? I haven't. What's happening in Puerto Rico? It's over for us, but the devastation and the rebuilding and the impact, you know, lives on. And it's like, I don't want to think about Puerto Rico a lot. You know, some of my best friend's family lives there. I don't want to know how bad it is. So let's go on to my recommendation for people to get the book if you want to have something of value in your life and make your world more meaningful. I feel that strongly about the book. I keep it by my bedside. It's not a book that you sit down and read from beginning to end. Stephen, would you agree? You have to stop and think and process and absorb and synthesize some of what you said. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to ask a couple more questions, like what's next for Stephen Most? You are now an important part of my story, so I'd like to know what we can be expecting next from you.
First of all, I feel that it's important to get Wilder Than Wild into as many communities as possible.
Me too.
So, and we have some opportunities. The head of CAL FIRE is going to screen it for the California legislature later this month. And we want to publicize the film so that people in communities everywhere will have discussions. We'll bring people together with film. So that's really my focus for this year. But you had mentioned my book and film about the Klamath Basin, River of Renewal. Well, that is something that interests me that is still an ongoing story for me, because what's going to happen in the next 2 years, most likely in 2021, is that 4 hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River will come down. This will be the largest dam removal and ecological restoration project in history. It's possible that the spring Chinook salmon will be reintroduced into the upper basin of the Klamath. So I'm following that story, and while it's daunting to launch another documentary or contemplate another book, it's something that I have to think about.
Like, you know what? It's so weird because, like, it's not about you. It's happening to you, and I get that. It's like some days I wish I was a wealth manager. Everybody understands what that is. You don't have to change behaviors, and it's easily translatable. But when you're trying to do the work that we're doing, it's really a calling. It's not a choice. I mean, that's how I feel. And I have a question for you. I mean, can we have some further dialogue? We have one of the most successful, highly acclaimed nonprofit theaters here in Tucson called The Loft. And the person who's the executive director is on the International Private Films Board. I mean, she's a thing in the film world because of the success of The Loft and the films they show there. Is that something that we could have further conversation about to possibly bring it to Tucson? I mean, talk about a hot spot of the world. We're sitting right in the middle of it.
I'd love to bring the film to Tucson, yes. I can't really organize that.
But we can talk more about it off air, because that might be one of the calls to action. And certainly in my purview of things that I might be able to help with. So I think that's really great. And before we come to a rapid close, is there any burning issue that I forgot? Something that's like as obvious as the nose on my face? Or, and I didn't mean to have a pun, burning issue, that you would like to share with us before we conclude the show?
If anyone in your audience does want to host a community screening, you can go to wilderthanwildfilm.org, and we have you can order a DVD, a discussion guide, a screening kit, the poster, and so on. That's really, I think, a response I hope some of you would take to this interview to organize a screening.
That's a wonderful call to action. And I think we can do that. I was last week I was in Petaluma, where it is very dry, just south of Sonoma, with people like Paul Hawken, and talking more about drawdown. I've had Paul on the show, and, you know, of course, it's all about re-sequestering carbon. Why do we need the trees and the rainforest? But I was with the people from the Pachamama Alliance, and our Tucson contingent made a commitment to come back and not just say, that was just a great experience, wasn't it? How do we keep telling the story and keep the story alive of the importance of the rainforests? And this would be a perfect activity that we could plan around here to keep the conversation going. We've got, you know, in our neighboring state, New Mexico, there's a major fire burning as we speak. And we all know that once the monsoons start, this is a tinderbox. I mean, there when the lightning strikes, the dry strikes start hitting, we're just positioned for a really big fire season. We had campgrounds and fire warnings already. We had them in early May, and that's very, very telling. So, Stephen, thank you. Thank you, Mary Lou Duray, for the connection, and thank you for the good work that you're doing on all of our behalf. Our air matters, our air quality, our trees matter, and you've done it. You've told the story in such a compelling and wonderful way, and I appreciate your sharing all that you did with us and for taking it on. I have a friend who's a documentary filmmaker, and it is really flipping hard. Yes, it's begging for money, calling for money, asking for money, trying to complete it, having this dream, and then all that goes with the making of the film. So a heartfelt thanks from me. Okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Gina. It's
it was
been an
so
honor
great.
To be on the show with you. Let's stay in touch.
Oh, we will stay in touch. And everybody, we have a great Down to Earth show on June 14th with Michelle Estevillo, Keeping Energy Bills Low When the Temperatures Get High. It's a local show, and on our national show on the 19th, Sabrina Helm, a very new topic for us, climate change and depression. Are they connected? And if you remember Stephen saying, there's post-traumatic stress now because of things that are happening, and they're starting to really see some research for early diagnosis of climate change. Everybody, make it a great, green, intentionally lived, and safe week, and get out there and just do the right thing. Thanks for being a part of my world.